and Augustus. On the death of the latter, it extended from the Atlantic on the west to the Armenian mountains and Arabian deserts on the east. On the south, the African deserts had alone stopped the conquering arms, while on the north, a line of natural boundaries was traced by the English Channel, Rhine, Danube, Black Sea, and Mount Caucasus. Warned by the ill success that attended the later campaigns of his generals on the lower Rhine, Augustus had cautioned his successors to aim at preserving rather than increasing their dominions. Thus it came about that between the years of 14 and 161 AD, when Marcus Aurelius succeeded to the throne, only two fresh conquests had been made. Britain, a source of more trouble than profit to the empire, and Dacia, conquered by Trajan in 106 AD. Natural boundaries and Roman legions kept peace and security for many years within the circle of Roman dominion. But there were two weak points on these borders. On the north, the hardy German tribes, on the Danube and Upper Rhine, themselves hard-pressed by Slavonian intruders from Russia, threatened to invade the Roman dominion. On the east, the insolent Parthian, long the terror of the Roman arms, was a constant source of trouble and danger. The peace-loving Marcus Aurelius was obliged to cope with both these enemies. The arms, or rather the army, of the insolent and profligate Lucius Verus, for a time subdued the Parthians, but no lasting peace was destined Marcus Aurelius. He himself conducted the campaigns on the Danube, and again and again beat back the northern enemy in wars, of which the chief interest to us now consists in the scant notes in the Meditations. This among the Quadi, this at Carmuntum, showing how these precious records of a pure and serene soul were composed amid the storms of battle and the elation of victory. Nor were his troubles confined to foreign wars. The plague, imported from the east, ravaged Italy, though it did the state good service in carrying off Lucius Verus, Marcus's adoptive brother, whom, in obedience to the wishes of Antoninus, he had associated with himself in the empire. There were famines, too, in the land, with which the emperor tried to cope by schemes of carefully organized charity. And, lastly, Avidius Cassius, one of his most trusted and ablest generals, revolted in Syria and tried to obtain for himself the empire, deeming it an easy matter to overcome a master who was so full of generosity and compassion that he could only inspire contempt in the mind of the unphilosophic soldier. The revolt was soon put down, but the leader was killed by one of his own officers. The emperor expressed only his regret that he should have been thus deprived of the luxury of forgiveness, and he carefully destroyed all documents that could implicate any others in the revolt. Thus, in all the trials of his life, his philosophy inspired noble action, and he might worthily be added to the short list of those whom the Stoics acknowledged as really good and great. Amid these records of gentleness and forbearance, it seems strange to read that Marcus Aurelius permitted a cruel persecution of the Christians. Among the victims of this reign were Justin Martyr and Polycarp, and numbers suffered in a general persecution of the churches at Lyon and Vienne. It must not, however, be forgotten that the persecution was political rather than religious. Of the true teaching of Christianity, Marcus Aurelius knew little and cared less. But its followers, in refusing to acknowledge a religion which included the emperors among its deities, became rebels against the existing order of things, and therein culpable. Of the old sincere belief in the gods of Rome, but little could survive in a state where the vote of the Senate had the power to add a new divinity to the already bewildering list. So much the more important were the outward forms, now that the actual belief was gone, and the bond between church and state grew even closer, now that the church could no longer stand alone. Of the various systems of philosophy at that time fashionable in Rome, all but the Epicurean could readily embody the creed of the old religion, and by treating the names of gods and heroes as mere symbols, they contrived to combine out